Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival 2021. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Gadigal. Always was, always will be Gadigal land. I acknowledge all the clans of the Sydney Basin and I pay my respects to them, to their elders, and I thank them for their custodianship of country. My name is Daniel Browning. I'm the producer and presenter of Away, which is the Indigenous art and culture program on ABC Radio National. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here to Gwayu for All Times, a celebration of what I think is a major contribution to First Nations poetry, a book curated by the writer Janine Lane. So published by Mugabala, Gwayu for All Times is a collection of 63 poems from 36 First Nations poets in 12 First Nations languages. And some of the poets I want to name check who aren't on the panel today, whose work is featured in Gwayu, are Lorna Munro, Lionel G. Fogarty, Evelyn Araluen, Ali Cobby Eckerman, Samuel Wagon Watson, Melanie Munanga Williams, Eric Avery, Claire G. Coleman, Gail Kennedy. The list goes on. There's 36 of them, so I'm not going to list them all, but I do acknowledge every single writer who's been curated into this collection. It was commissioned by Red Room Poetry, and it's stunning and electric. Curated by Janine Lane, Gwayu is a major contribution to Australian poetry, and in my opinion, it represents a deepening of the national conversation. Because these are not just poems, but political statements. They're demands for social justice. They're assertions of presence, of continuity and self-determination that celebrate culture, community, land, language and identity. Now to introduce some of these people, Tony Birch in his remarks on the book, in his blurb, he reckons the writers in this collection are an ensemble of literary warriors who've gathered to shake us from our slumber. Natalie Harkin, another First Nations poet, describes Gwayu as a loving gift. So I'd like to introduce some of those literary warriors who are here on the panel today. Ellen Van Nierven belongs to the Mananjali Yugambeh people of Southeast Queensland. Ellen is an award-winning writer, editor, and literary activist. They've authored three books, including a new poetry collection called Throat, which we'll talk about. And it's an extraordinary, awarded collection. And Throat explores different ways to be heard. And they've also edited the anthology Flock, First Nations Stories Then and Now. Could you please welcome Ellen Van Nierven? Nadi Simpson is a Yuwalarai storyteller from the New South Wales Northwest Freshwater Plains. Nadi is a musician, composer and playwright. The author of Song of the Crocodile, another incredible contribution, published by Hachette in October 2020. Song of the Crocodile was the 2018 winner of the Black and White Fellowship, shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards in the Indigenous Writing category. Nadi is currently undertaking a PhD in composition at ANU, researching the traditions of song and story in her beloved Yuwalarai homelands. Please welcome Nadi. Curly Saunders is a proud Gunai woman, teacher and artist, and an award-winning international writer of poetry, plays and picture books. In 2020, Curly was named the New South Wales Aboriginal Woman of the Year. Curly created poetry in first languages, which we're going to hear about today, delivered by Red Room Poetry, supporting First Nations language conservation and celebration through the arts. Her poetry collection, Kindred, was shortlisted for the ABIA 2020 Book Awards. Her most recent work, Bindi, is a verse novel for young readers and was the inaugural winner of the WA Premier's Daisy Utamora Award. And she's currently working on a sequel. Please welcome Curly Saunders. And Joel Davison is a Gadigal and Dungari man from Sydney. He's working to revitalise his family's language. He joined Red Room Poetry to explore his connection to language and to country. In his 9-to-5, currently, for the minute, he leads technology projects at the Commonwealth Bank. Please welcome Joel. (Applause) Ellen, there's a number of award winners today here on this panel. In fact, almost everyone. Ellen, congratulations on your latest collection, Throat, New South Wales Book of the Year. It's also won the Kenneth Slessor and the New South Wales Multicultural Award. First time a book of poetry has won in that Book of the Year category since inception, or no? Ruby Moonlight, Ali Kobi-Eckermann.
Since 2013, yeah. Ruby Moonlight, Ali Kobi-Eckermann, yeah.
Yes, so it's not the only book of poetry to win a Book of the Year. But what does poetry, a big question, what does poetry articulate that prose doesn't?
Daniel, wow, you're really, really kicking things off.
Start big, and I start with the big ideas.
Well, I think we'll hear soon from Curly about the sovereign way that this book has come together through poetry and language, because I don't feel like we could have done prose and language, Curly, but I don't feel like it would have been this powerful sense of connection to way back, you know, like this real continuance to our ancestors and their writing, you know, like their storytelling, their creations. So I feel a sense of, when I'm writing poetry, a feeling of power that I don't get when I'm writing prose.
And I think there's I would describe poetry as a kind of lyric or lyrical storytelling. And Nadi, given your background in music, we've talked about the transition from the discipline and meter of music to prose. But I guess in this collection, you've kind of gone back. What do you think about this idea of the lyric storytelling, the poem being an expression of our ancestral voice?
Yeah, that's a hard one too. I was thinking about the relationship within the words, what it's relating to. So in music, I mean, you know, the one thing I do know, when you create a song, the words needs the melody, and that's the context for those things. Take that away, I get really excited to listen actually to these fellas and learn the relationship with the words, minus music, sets it free, flying out the door there. How deadly is that? Just the power of the drifting word to go and find a place to settle. That's how I understand all this business, sovereignty and power and culture. Where's the relationship? And how do you not confine that? That's sort of how I understand poetry in my own mind.
And just reading Song of the Crocodile, we were talking in the green room, Ellen and I, kind of, you were within earshot, but we were saying
You're
how
talking
much...
Talking about me. Here
talking
we go.
About you, yeah. how much... If I found that when I was reading Song of the Crocodile, which is a work of prose, if I read it aloud, it deepened the meaning. Yeah. And it became more like poetry.
Yeah. Thanks. Deadly. But I think there's something in speaking... it's not speaking. Something in your body connecting to a string of words. No feeling like it, eh? Different to singing, because the melody's doing something. When it's just your vocal cord and your whatever spirit and the words, it's a feeling that has a shape within you. That's why whenever I write something, I speak it out, because it's flat without a person. That's what I reckon.
Curly, this is what you do. Poetry is your life, is your art form. How do you understand how this form expresses something that all other forms can't express. What does poetry mean?
Before I start, yeah, I acknowledge Mirani Gananugang Gadigal Ma Dungboring Gilingyangu and all mob in the room. Hey, it's real good to see you. Thank you so much for sharing stories with us. And there's some very powerful storytellers in this audience too. So it's interesting to be on a panel. I love looking around the room and being like, I'd love to ask this person and this person and this person. And actually, my answer about what poetry means to me is shaped around Dr. Tamron Bennett, who's in the back of the room here. Who says that we should live our poem and we should live poetry. It should be a way of life and not just something on the page. And since Tamron told me that when I started working at Red Room, I've been trying to live a poem instead of just put it on a page. And I tell you, sometimes she's a messy first draft, my poem page life, and other times it's something far more eloquent and it has that shape and it has that fluidity and flow that you're speaking about, sis. And for me, poetry underpins every one of my writing forms, and it's now getting turned into art and music and all kinds of things. But I think I agree with Tamron that poetry should be the way that we live our life and not just something in a book that sits on a page. Yeah.
Joel, how did you come to write poetry? I mean, you were tapped on the shoulder by Red Room to write some poems, not just in English, but in Gadigal language, the language of the country where we are today. What does poetry express for you?
Yeah, so I guess I came to start doing poetry because I find it impossible to say no.
thank God.
Yeah, thank goodness. My sort of experience, I like to say, is an Olympic-sized kiddie pool. I've got no deep ends to what I do, but I've got a little bit of everything because of that. I guess from the very beginning, I was a apprentice at the Botanic Gardens doing horticulture, and I got asked to do some classes there in the education department. And then Sydney Festival asked me to teach some language classes, and then Curly asked me to come on board with Poetry for First Languages. And each step of the way, it was like, oh, okay, I've never taught before, but I guess I know some plants. And then, oh, I can't speak language, but I guess I've taught before. And then, oh, I can't do poetry, but I guess I've learnt language from Aunty Jackie Troy and Aunty Jacinta Tobin. And that's how I got to where I am. Poetry for me has been like, I am a very goals-oriented person in how I put myself out there and in my work and activism and et cetera. So it's, when I think about committing my time to writing something, I'm very deliberate and I want people to walk away with the message that I'm putting out there. And then poetry is sort of like, okay, no, this is for you. I found that it does get the message out there, but in a beautifully mind-twisting way that I hadn't considered before. It's like, they took my Windows 95 screensaver brain and shook it up and spilt it onto the floor, and people loved it.
They really did.
Thank you.
And on that note, I would ask that, you know, one of the poems that you've written in this collection, which is in Gadigal language, when I hear you speak your language, it's always kind of transformative, and I love the echo of Gadigal language on Gadigal country. So I'd like to invite you to read, it's your choice, but I would like you to read something that has, because you've also written in this collection, you talked to me before about writing in Gadigal first and English second, and privileging, you know, our oral literatures and our stories and our ancestors by doing that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For so long we have catered our language to English language speakers, first and foremost. So I you know, as best I can, as authentically as I can, which is not authentic as possible because I am an English first language speaker, like to write it with Gadigal language in mind first. And the English meanings that come out of that from that three layers of translation is very different to how I would have articulated it in English. But yeah, I appreciate your invitation to read. This is an excerpt from The Wounded Brave, published through Red Room Poetry. Bayawurajanun Jirunjanun. We are all wounded. We all fear. Dyar Baba Numbuni Nimagai. We will never grow weary or let our fire burn out. Burawanunla Namin Mawawi Nundara. Let's move upward and show our teeth. Yananunla Barayanunla Maribula. Let's move forward and sing out loud. Na wala Mimugurubuni Yananun Ninarigai Ganamanui. Look. Do not close your eyes. We walk together with feet on fire.
Yeah, there's something in the language, Curly, which you understand. And in being the founder of the Poetry in First Languages initiative, an initiative of Red Room, this is something that you know. So maybe can you tell the audience a little bit about Poetry in First Languages? Because it's very much the starting point, I think, for this collection.
Thank you. So Red Room aims to make poetry in meaningful ways. And I was working at Red Room in the education team and then sat down with Tamron after this crazy experience on the Shoalhaven River down that way, Bungali, on Yuin country. And I had heard ancestors sing for the first time. And I thought I was going crazy. I called my aunties. Hey Val, hey Trish, what's going on? I got these voices in my head. And they said, well, Bob, what are they saying? I said, well, it's, I don't know. And they said, that's it. It's time to go and learn language. You know, what are you going to do? And I reached out to Tamron and said, Tamron, I got this crazy idea. And I know there's other wonderful language projects already out in the world. And that Mob have been teaching and singing language and poems and language, they go together in some way. And, you know, I know Lorna had been doing wonderful things too. And I thought, I want to create something where elders get to be with poets on country, and there's this connection, and we get to teach language in whatever ways feel traditional and contemporary, and allow children to explore caring for country and their own identity. And so we taught across 12 different communities in the Territory, New South Wales and ACT, and created and published poetry with wonderful commissioned writers who featured language in their poems that they had learned from elders and custodians. And then one of the goals was, Tamron, I want to see these published. And of course, Red Room has an incredible poetry library. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Also look at all their other wonderful projects. Then we brought in Magabala and commissioned across the full spectrum of all of the First Nations poets that Red Room had been working with prior to me being there, which is an incredible collection of wonderful writers. And Gawaii was born, and yeah, Aunty Janine here helped us facilitate by editing, and she's done such an incredible job weaving together such a spectrum of experiences of First Nations people. And I feel so grateful to have been involved and to be able to call people up and, hey brother, what language are you teaching? Who are you working with? Hey sis, have you learned language before? Can I support you in that? Auntie, I know that you've been teaching language. Can I bring you on country with these bobbies? Do you have a moment to share with these people? And we saw children write poems for the first time and they'd never written anything before. And plant trees for black cockatoos, which were endangered in the local area, and then their poems about that experience fly around town on bus backs and keep cups and ferries and trains, and people be immersed in language in the public sphere. And I think it was just a continuation of all the wonderful things already happening in the world with language, and thankfully it continues in new ways now with this book, which walks out in hands with people, or the yarns they hear, or ends up in classes and sparks more conversation.
We are going to hear from Janine towards the end. Janine, an accomplished writer herself, a curator of this extraordinary collection, And on the cover of the book, you see this kind of mesh, this kind of net form. And Janine, in her introduction, her foreword to this collection, describes Gwayo as a radical collection, a radical intervention, in Aboriginal publishing. And that's because of its breadth of representation, diversity of language, and drafting and editing protocols. And Janine describes poetry as a weaving and poems as being something like vessels or baskets or nets. And just as weaving is a series of intricately connected threads that loop, twine, coil, spiral and braid, the poets in Gwayo loop, twine, coil and spiral words together as threads in a vessel. And I'm really interested in this idea of continuity and of poetry being a form of weaving, like a thing that we do with our hands almost a thing that is in the physical world.
Weaving words.
Weaving yeah. words. Mm. Is that something that you kind of, can you relate to that to poetry as being something like that?
Yeah, I felt really safe to sort of participate in this project through Curly's, establishment of poetry in first languages, Red Room, with Janine, being the editor and the gatherer of these threads, and her fantastic foreword, which for me I got goosebumps reading it because it did articulate my relationship with writing and how I felt. Blackfella owned publishing house in Mugabala was extremely important. When I got my copies of this book, I very quickly gave them to people. And very quickly, I had none left. I was sort of looking around, where's my copy this morning? Because it's like a beautiful basket. And it doesn't feel like there's any yuckiness or ickiness that sometimes happens with the commodification of ourselves as Blackfella writers. And you pour your heart and soul into something and you bring your community with you. And then there's sort of a bit of a hollowing out that occurs when, white institutions and white publishing houses produce your work. So I didn't feel that with this. I felt very... It felt like an object, a treasure, a gift, as one of the quotes on the back of the book says. And so I gave it to all of the people that I knew that were on their own writing journey. So I gave it to... I'm working with elders in Inala, which is just out of, for those who don't know, Inala is just a little bit out of Brisbane, like really strong black community there. And we're doing a poetry project with the elders and have 10 elders, and I gave them my copies of the book, and I saw the way that they interacted with it. It was like, this is real. It's not gammon, and it just kind of sparked, I think it's one of those books that's like, yeah, has a spark and kind of keeps going. I feel incredibly honored to be part of the collection, a collection like this.
Nadia, the book does have form, and I know that you have worked with objects in the Australian Museum, the sound of ancestral objects, a fascinating project some years ago in trying to find the voice that is resting or asleep in our in our ancestral things, our ancestral collections. Does this feel like it has form? Sometimes when you write, music has form. It creates vibration. But when you're writing, are you thinking about this as kind of being like a basket or something that you could pass on to someone else? I always think words are actions. People talk about the primacy of action, of physical action over what we say, whereas I think words are actions. It depends on you.
Mm. When you're talking and I'm thinking, it's all weaving in together. I think when you are invited into a space like that, actually, and we're all working disconnected from each other, but the connection is waiting for us. I think the writing is actually listening in a very different way to how you would with music. But it's tuning in and listening, just like those old girls singing to you. So you're writing, you're listening, rather than doing the action. You know? If I would have known I was doing that there, I would have been real, you know, proud of myself. I'm only understanding it now as we're talking and thinking and weaving ourselves back into the making. That silence. Music is about silence. You craft the silence because that's the thing that people feel. And how would I relate that to this? You're writing, you're listening. You're tuning in to that kind of... some people hear it as sound, I would say. Some people see words or whatever. For some people, it's movement. You're tuning in to those maybe invisible things and you're writing yourself, watching or listening that. That's a way. And so then, you know, of course blackfellas, are deadly at this because it's movement and image and making and singing. We're born for that. Like, look at these people. They're showing you how great our families and communities are at this. And so blackfellas brush against this form and it talks the same language. I love that. It's deadly, eh?
Absolutely. And it's also like this idea of poetry not being distinct from anything else. It's like a dance not being its own art form, and of understanding culture as a continuous practice and of everything being interconnected.
Yeah, totally. Like the genres and like separation, that's like a white thing, not a black thing. Yeah.
On that note, can you... I know you've got a poem that is in this collection.
Yeah.
There is a poem that's in language, but you're going to read the one in English.
And the explanation for that. So there is... so I do have a few poems in Gwayi. I have a poem that I wrote a few years ago as part of another Red Room project called Poetry Object, which is the one that I'm going to read today. And then the Poetry in First Languages poems, when Curly asked me to, thank you, to be part of the project. As Curly said before, it involves the poet connecting with a language custodian. So I connected with Sean Davis, who's a cousin, who works at the Yugambeh Museum. He's got language, our cousin, yeah. So we are connected, and the first question was, what am I going to write? Knowing for the first time my words are going to be interpreted. We used interpreted instead of translated because there is no direct translation. So, you know, completely different languages, completely different ways of being and seeing the world and relating. Like, you know, for example, because I told Sean I wanted to write poems addressed to my nana, to my mum's mum. I just said it how we say it, you know, mum's mum. But in the poem, I think it just had grandmother. So he said, you know, is it your mum's mum or your dad's mum? You know, like, because there's different words. So, you know, the way that that relationality is embedded in the language, you know, the shortcuts, you know, that we do through through language. So I said, you know, I'm going to be writing these poems. They're going to be interpreted in Yugunbe. I'm going to address them to my nana. What am I going to say? It was really sort of put me in the real place of mixed emotions, you know? I managed to say to know what I wanted to say, which is very, very simple. I wanted to tell Nana, who's passed away, but I believe she's here. I wanted to tell her that I loved her. I wanted to talk to her about our country, it's in present tense, which I think is important, because we are present, we're past, present and future all at once. And so I sent it to Sean, and because of the way things, I think the world was at that moment, Sean and I corresponded through email. And we keep putting a rain check on when we're actually going to catch up in person. And so I got the interpretations, and I was really moved. Sean's a language expert. I'm still don't feel in that position yet to read those poems out loud. So that's me. I did want to read today this poem called Oyster Shell Necklace. And it's a poem that was made in another place entirely. It's a poem that I wrote when I was in Tasmania. And I dedicated it to Uncle Jim and Auntie Patsy, Uncle Jim Everett and Auntie Patsy Cameron, who I met my first and only time there. And I had the gift of meeting them and having that their custodianship, their eldership, them reaching out to me while I was there, which I really appreciated. And I also got to meet Brother Adam there as well, who's here, my first trip there. And this poem came from, I'll explain it at the end, but it came from a gift that Uncle Jim gave to me when I met him. Oyster Shell Necklace. I didn't fill the bay or make the rocks. I didn't. Here Tassie's haunted. Wasn't sure how I'd feel. I feel. Water in your welcome. The clouds, the blood, water. All feeds all. Mud oysters, mutton birds, all feeds. Parting gift, shell in your hands, now in my hands, on your neck, now on my neck. Safe travel, with shells stringed close, heartbeat close. Thank you.
In terms of, you know, legacies, we're talking about, I think all of us are walking in the footsteps on the shoulders, standing on the shoulders of giants. And legacies is something we talk about a lot without actually, you know, necessarily saying that. But Uncle Jim is one of those elders to whom, you know, one of those legacies that we carry with us. And it's a shame that, you know, he can't be here and he can't talk, but he's a man who speaks in poetry. Like, I've traveled the world with him, and everything was a poem.
He's incredible.
Yeah, incredible man. In terms of legacies, Curly, you know, as a young, relatively young poet, someone who's just won the ABIA for Small Publishers Award for Bindi, the most recent collection. Congratulations. What do those legacies mean if you're looking back at, you know, what the work of other poets, our elders, the people who've inspired us to use this form kind of in the contemporary sense?
Oh, they're the footholds, right? So that we know the right way to go. And, the path laid out so that you know how to place your own space so that somebody else has got a path to move on. And I think, learning language, teaching language, seeing... I have had the most incredible conversations with elders on this journey of learning language and supporting language teaching or writing poems or, you know, meeting some of our incredible writers in the room. And I think all of those interactions have supported me on my path, and I know that they'll support somebody else on theirs. And there's this incredible generosity, less a legacy, I suppose, in the things that have come before shaping the way that we move next. And I feel, really grateful that so many of our old people and the people in this room have laid down those footstones for younger ones like me. And that every time I meet a young person, like I'm working with kids today or whenever that is, that there is that beautiful interaction. They're teaching me something I don't know or seeing the world in a different way, and they shape my footstone to, you know, somewhere to move next. So... yeah, legacy feels like a strange word to me. It feels like a white word. But the idea of footholds or a path or a trajectory that, you know, that interweave of past, present and future, all things at all times together, that feels like a beautiful thing to be a part of.
We're going to establish the meaning of that word, guwayu, which I don't feel I have a right to project into the world. We're going to hear from Janine Lane shortly when we open the floor for questions. But that idea of the contemporaneity of the past, of linearity, of this, there's no linear, there's no history, there's no vertical, there's no up and down, there's no trajectory towards, you know, in this kind of, in this Writers' Festival, they're talking about within reach and about, I guess, of this idea of trajectory is inherent in that. So I always talk about the contemporaneity of the past and the past being utterly present. And Ellen talks about her grandmother being here. But I think that's also a feature of you know, in the poetic world, everything is contemporaneous. The past is contemporary. And in a lot of these works, actually, there's no sense of that happened back then, this is now, this is all, it's all together and it's all happening right here. On that note, Curly, I mean, I would love to hear you read something of yours from this collection.
Thank you. I'll be reading Disconnection. I wrote this piece after that experience on the riverbed, and I got to interpret it years later after working with Ani Val-Mulcahy and Trish Levitt, who both work in language teaching in the Southern Highlands where I was raised. And I'm very grateful to them both for supporting me on my language journey and for helping me to be able to support others on their language journey. Gujaga, Nya Gamiri Nyayini Mundu, empty spaces, for Gamawang words to fill, and stretch your guri for the piala and their voices. Nya Gamiri, your trembling limbs ache to shake in Tangara and hear your lungs as they gasp Yungumba. Now feel your body, sans buringiling, yabun and secret, and know that it is being grown with roots wrenched from the da'auri that cradled them. And now taste the hunger, nyanyanidu, to know the parts of yourself, to feel your wong when your dui has been taken. Which means, little one, I see you mouth empty spaces for a mother's words to fill and stretch your ears for the stories and their voices. I watch your trembling limbs ache to shake in dance and hear your lungs as they gasp with songs unknown. I feel your body, sans spirit, ceremony and secret, and know that it is being grown with roots wrenched from the earth that cradled them. And I taste the hunger you do to know the parts of yourself, to feel at home when your dreaming has been taken.
What I love about that particular poem is there's no key. If you don't understand, you've got to get a sense of where the words are leading. And if you don't have a sense of that viscerally, it doesn't matter that you don't know that word. You have to kind of imagine it comes to you. I mean, and that's a deliberate choice about projecting our languages into space and re-articulating them and putting them back in our mouths, essentially.
Yeah. I think one thing that Ginny and I spoke a lot about, and Annie Tafiu in the room, by the way, incredible Māori wahine, doing incredible things in writing in her own way. But we spoke a lot about the decolonization of publishing during the creation of this book, and how language can't be othered, and that there has to be a particular formatting for the way that language shows up in this book so that there isn't the othering, which has happened in the past in other collections. And I think that understanding context and language, the way that meaning is portrayed and shared in language, how some words have a translation or interpretation but can't fully articulate exactly what we're speaking to, were ideas that we really wanted to include in shaping this book. And it's such a beautiful thing when I pick it up and read any of my brothers and sisters, aunties, uncles, these incredible words, in language or not, that they are very intentional. Everything has its place and its purpose, and all of them have been woven in this beautiful collection to hold space and share stories and make people feel seen and heard. And yeah, I think Aunty Janine there nailed it when she sorted out all that formatting stuff.
Indeed. Nadi, you've got something you want to read. It's not from, you've got Shirley from the collection, you don't have to.
We were talking in the green room.
We were.
There's a song that was printed and I read it. So lame. So lame. Seriously, it was so lame. But I think I know why. It's a little bit to do with me, but a little bit to do with the, like I was talking about, the relationship in that thing was with sound. So when I read it, so I'm going to do something else. And this is about mothers. Birangulu is the mother of all Yualare people. Ganambili, she's our second boss, and she has the babies and makes the flood. And Gunima is Mother Earth. And in this piece, not a song, not a poem, it's something, in this thing, we're saying, you know, calling out to those ladies and saying, we're singing real strong for you, and telling the women beside us, hit that possum skin hard so they know us and they can hear us. Birangulu, bawila nangiani ngunginunda mayo. Birangulu, Bawila ngiani nganginunda mayu birangulu. Wiringa bamba garu. Wenangali birangulu. Bawila ngiani nganginunda mayu. Ganan bili. Bawila ngiani nganginunda mayu. Ganan bili. Bawilangi aningu nginu da mayu ganambili. Wiringa bumala bamba wenangali ganambili. Bawilangi aningu nginu da mayu. Gunima. Bawilangi aningu nginu da mayu. Gunima. Bawilangi aningu nginu da Babulana Mayu Gunima Wuringa Bumala Nginunda Mayu Gunima Babulana Nianingo Nginunda Mayu Giro.
It's all about beautiful semitones and notes and chords and vibration in that. And you create what's happening there. I see those old girls at a campfire and something happening there. Maybe they're talking about the birth of someone, another one coming through. I don't know. I
mean, same when Joel was talking, did you hear his voice? Went somewhere, brah. Somewhere that was further than where we are now. That's you. But it's also what's working through you. Language, you know? It's the boss of us in a really good way. How lucky we get to play with words for a living because we've got all that we can draw from.
I think on that note, we should probably hear from the curator of this collection we're very lucky to be joined by Janine Lane, who's sitting in the front row here, but I'll ask you, Janine, if you could come to a microphone. Can you please welcome Janine Lane?
Yeah, yurdu marang, everyone. Look, the panel did a wonderful job. In speaking to the huge artistic and community project that this anthology was. The title, Guwayu, is a Wiradjuri word that I chose because I was fortunate enough to be asked to be the gatherer of this wonderful collection. And refusing the term editor, because that's what white people do. Guwayu is a Wiradjuri word that means for all and in all and with all times. There's no, as we talked about, the panel talked about, there's no exact translation, but that's the interpretation. And what it really means is all times are important and no times are resolved. And it resists any kind of linearity of time. There is no history, there is no future. We're all in a story. And nothing has been resolved, but nothing is equally irresolvable. Only white people think that the past, or those past, like Ellen's Nana, don't speak, they speak all the time. I think that's the limitation of the settler mentality, that you might think that those past don't speak, they speak all the time. And through this book, and this book was wanting to gathering, it's a gathering, and gathering is more than just gathering physical things. I was taught as a child that gathering is about gathering histories and stories and longevity of people together in one, and keeping that going. So the title was to acknowledge that we are, were, are and always will be here for all times. None of these times are resolved, and all of these times are incredibly important. And the book was a really radical intervention in Australian publishing. I began with the assumption that everyone is a poet, and I wasn't up for a sifting and sorting process. And also through this book, I really wanted to acknowledge our elders, and our elders past and present, and our elders in writing, and also wanted to acknowledge that our elders don't get acknowledged enough at festivals like this. And I'd like to thank the panel, because the book, this book did more than recognising poetry as an art form. It does recognise poetry as an art form, and a beautiful art form. It's a beautiful, seamless weaving of First Nations offerings, but it does more than that. It recognises the great capacity for of poetry for change and social justice, and the reflective capacity of poetry. So, Mandanguru, thank you.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but Joel, it does occur to me that you know, I'd like if you've got another poem in you, and I've certainly heard a number of them. You're so great at projecting Gadigal language into space, and I think it would be fitting if you could do that again.
Yeah, that'd be great. I actually haven't spoken this one aloud much, but I think it's a perfect time for it. It's a poem about this city, which I spend a lot of time thinking about. It's hard to decolonize when there's an entire city on your ancestral lands. But I just quit my job earlier this week, and I'm moving down to Melbourne. it's kind of a big week.
You also won an award last night.
Yeah, a pretty big one.
A pretty big one, yeah.
APRA Song of the Year with Midnight Oil and Uncle Bunna Lorry and Kalina Briggs and Dan Sultan.
That's true, for my contribution to Gadigal Land. So, big, big week, and I think it's appropriate that I read this poem because it's about meeting the love of my life in Sydney and reconciling the Sydney that I live in now and the Sydney that my ancestors lived, loved, and died on before there was a city of Sydney here. So this one's called My City. A city stands on ancestral lands, Yagu Winama. Now, close. I found a void where it is made perfect. Passing as white, painted up white, in white rabbit laughing at white canvas. Painted white, white, painted white, and mourning, we laughed hysterically. Dabuwa mili, jiramubi, barianun. Ignited my life and my love. Naya butbut, Gunamamiwia, you set my heart on fire. A city stands on ancestral lands, my hands wider than my ancestors' hands. My city stands on ancestral lands. Gamarabu Guugu, Barabugu Barabawari Dharmi. Today, now, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, my city for a long time.
And what a way to finish. Can you please join me in thanking our panel, Ellen Van Nieuwen, Nadi Simpson, Curly Saunders, and Joel Davison.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.